This is Audible.
The Key by Catherine Hughes. Read by Joanne Froggatt. Prologue, November 1956. I've been half walking, half running since I crept out of the house. My chest heaves and my breath escapes in ragged gasps. The streets are deserted, and I'm grateful for that small mercy. I won't be forced to explain myself to our inquisitive neighbours. Behind closed doors, someone is frying onions, and the sweet smell wafts in front of me. The tantalising aroma reminding me that I've not eaten. Ahead of me, a ginger Tom strolls out from behind a hedge and sits down on the pavement, the glow from the gas lamp illuminating his orange fur. As I draw closer, he stands up and moves towards me, his tail erect except for the tip which curls over. He tilts his chin upwards and mews a greeting to me. Normally, I might have bent down and given him a little tickle, but not tonight. There's nothing normal about tonight. I round the corner, and as the park gates come into view, I'm momentarily surprised by how quickly I've arrived here. With a glance behind me, I push open the rusty iron gate, the ancient hinges squeaking in protest. The sound cuts through the still night air, sabotaging what was supposed to be a stealthy entrance, but I do feel safer now that I'm in the sanctuary of the park, and begin to slow my pace a little. Not too much, though. It's important to keep moving. There's no room for complacency. The pungent smell of the stagnant, weed-filled water tells me the lake is just round the corner, and I lengthen my stride until it comes into view. The water laps on the shingle beach, and a couple of swans doze beside an upturned rowing boat. The cold almost chokes me as I take my first tentative step into the icy water. The stones beneath my bare feet are sharp, and a piece of slimy pondweed wraps itself around my ankles. I turn around and look at the shoes I kicked off only moments before. They are lying on the shingle about a foot apart, and one is upside down. I inwardly chastise myself for my uncharacteristic sloppiness. They should have been placed neatly side by side, just as my mother always taught me. She will be disappointed, for in a few moments, those shoes will be all that's left of me. It's the only reason I took them off. My feet ache with the cold, but I take another couple of steps. Now the water is up to my knees. My skirt billows around my legs, the only movement in the dark, tranquil lake. I've been here many times before, but never at this time, never like this. The sky is clear and black, very black. There's only a crescent moon, and the lack of light allows the stars to pepper the night sky. From somewhere in the trees, an owl takes flight, screeching as it glides just above the surface of the lake. It startles me, and I stumble backwards but manage to remain upright. I take a few calming breaths. I can still see my feet through the murky water. Tiny feet, size 3 and bone white. Another few steps and the water is up to my waist. I feel like I'm suffocating already. There's blackness all around. Not just in the sky, but in the water, in my heart, and in my head. There's sadness too. There's always been sadness. I wear it like a cloak, a great big heavy cloak that swamps me, a cloak I am unable to shrug off. I'm in a rush to get it over with now. Just another couple of strides and peace will be mine. I gaze down at the sleeping baby in my arms, but I don't feel anything. I didn't expect to. The screeching starts again, shrill and desperate. But I don't need to turn round to know it's not the owl this time. It's something else. Chapter 1. September 2006. She watched him as he stood in front of the hall mirror, brushing imaginary flecks of dandruff from the shoulders of his beige camel coat. His sandalwood cologne floated around on the breeze from the open window. He was still a handsome man. Age had not withered him, and although his hair was now white, it was enviably thick, while his dark eyes held a sparkle that had not been dimmed in spite of his grief. "Morning, Dad. You off to the cemetery, then?" He gave her a thin smile.
"Yes, Sarah. Where else would I be going?"
She adjusted the knot in his tie and gave him a peck on the cheek. "It's been 6 months, Dad. You don't need to go every day."
"I know I don't need to, Sarah. I want to."
He bent down to give his already polished shoes one last buff with the soft brush he kept on the hall table. He straightened up and looked her directly in the eye, his tone gentle, almost pleading.
"It would be nice if you came with me once in a while."
She suppressed an impatient groan. She couldn't bear having the same conversation over and over again. "I don't need to keep going to Mum's grave in order to remember her." She thumped her chest. "I carry her in here every moment of every day." He sighed, picked up her hand and kissed it.
"As you wish. But we need to think about planting some bulbs soon. I want there to be lots of colour during the drab winter months. I'll get some snowdrops, I think. They come out early, don't they? And then some crocuses and daffodils. At least the bloody rabbits won't chew their way through those."
He gave a small chuckle.
"Hey, what do you think?"
Sarah unhooked the bag from the newel post and slung the strap over her shoulder. "All right, then. I'll pick some up from the garden centre on my way back." He raised his eyebrows.
"On your way back from where?"
"Dad," she said, dragging the word out. "You know very well where I'm going."
"Oh, please tell me you're not still snooping round that place."
"I'm not snooping. It's called research." She regretted her sharp tone when she saw the hurt look in his eyes, and softened her voice. "And you're a primary source, Dad. Have you any idea how valuable that is to a historian? You want my book to be a success, don't you?"
"A historian now, are you? I thought you worked at the local library."
"Yes, Dad, that's my job. We all have bills to pay, but this book's my passion. And your input could mean the difference between it being a good book and an absolutely brilliant one."
"I've told you before," he said, his voice weary. "I don't want to talk about it." He jabbed his finger towards her. "And don't come running to me when you're done for trespassing."
"It's not trespassing, it's urban exploration." She noticed his tight jaw and the change in his breathing. She tugged gently on the sleeve of his coat.
"Please, just tell me what it was like in there," she whispered. "I promise if it gets too uncomfortable, we'll stop. Just tell me as much as you want to."
He opened the front door and sighed irritably at the rain bouncing off the driveway. Picking up his umbrella from the hall stand, he brandished it at her like a sword. She took a startled step backwards.
"I've already told you as much as I want to."
"Yeah, which amounts to precisely nothing." He opened the umbrella and held it over his head.
"Some things are best just left in the past, Sarah, and that's my final word on the matter."
She watched as he strode off down the path, willing him to turn round and give her an apologetic wave. Without her mother around to dilute his moods, he could be unbearably cantankerous. Mum had been good for him. She'd never allowed him to sulk, and could lift him out of a black mood with just a well-timed quip, usually at his expense, her infectious laugh making it impossible for him to be down for long. Sarah was certain that he had loved her mother. She'd witnessed his devastation at losing her, his pit of grief so deep that she feared he would never find the strength to crawl out of it. His daily visits to her grave had become an obsession rather than routine. And yet she felt there was something missing.
Not enough to negate their marriage or diminish their love for each other. Just something that wasn't quite right. She likened it to completing a 1,000-piece jigsaw, but then finding that you've only got 999 pieces. That one missing piece spoils the whole effect. It's still clear what the picture is, but your eye will always be drawn to the little space where that missing piece should be. And Sarah didn't know why, but she had the uneasy feeling that the missing piece had something to do with Ambergate Lunatic Asylum. She'd been coming to Ambergate for 4 months now, but every time she rounded the corner and the stunning building came into view, the sheer grandeur of it made her gasp. She'd seen stately homes less well appointed. Constructed from the finest limestone, the facade appeared lavish, pretentious even. The octagonal cupola of the clock tower rising majestically over the arched doorway. No expense had been spared in the construction of the asylum. And although many of its more valuable features had long since been pilfered, some sections of the fine glazed wall tiles remained, along with the stained glass windows that adorned the ballroom. It was derelict now, of course, most of its windows smashed and the stonework crumbling beneath the invasive tendrils of ivy. Sarah pulled a book from her bag and stared at the black-and-white photograph taken around the turn of the last century. Ambergate County Lunatic Asylum, circa 1898. She read the paragraph below the photo. Constructed between 1870 and 1872 to a design by renowned architect Sir Leonard Groves, Ambergate County Lunatic Asylum was originally built to care for 1,000 patients from the Manchester, Liverpool and Chester areas. By the 1950s, it housed over 1,500 patients, resulting in severe overcrowding. In line with a national effort to reduce the stigma associated with the words lunatic asylum, the name was changed to Ambergate Mental Hospital in 1925. A further name change was effected after the passing of the 1959 Mental Health Act, which decreed that the word mental be omitted from hospital names. Ambergate Hospital closed its doors in 1997, and the building has been derelict ever since, some of it falling prey to arsonists and vandals. Spots of rain fell on the pages, and she thrust the book back into her bag before picking her way along the sweeping driveway. She arrived at the metal security hoardings and stared at the warning sign advising people not to venture any further. It stated that the site was monitored 24 hours a day and depicted a particularly aggressive-looking Alsatian, its long fangs dripping with saliva. There were no dogs here, though. It was only a deterrent, and the monitoring was carried out sporadically by an old guy rumoured to be a former patient, who wandered the grounds occasionally shouting profanities and shaking his fist in the direction of anybody who dared to ignore the signs. Sarah lifted the hoarding out of its concrete base, creating a small gap she could squeeze through. She waited for a second, scanning the grounds, holding her breath to make it easier to hear any unfamiliar noises. The breeze rustled the leaves on the trees, and a pigeon cooed softly to its mate. But otherwise, there was nothing. The security really was a joke. She crossed the weed-ridden front lawn, the long wet grass reaching the top of her thighs, and arrived at the foot of the stone steps leading up to the main entrance. She gripped the once ornate handrail, now merely a rusting eyesore, and climbed to the partially boarded-up front door, on which someone had hilariously daubed a pentagram in bright red paint. She pushed on the rotten wood and it yielded without much force, allowing her to step over the threshold and into the hallway. The overwhelming atmosphere inside was one of decay. Mildew covered the walls and pigeon droppings speckled the floor. The stench of urine permeated the air, and Sarah covered her nose with her hand. Broken bottles, cigarette butts, and the remains of a disposable barbecue indicated that some sort of gathering had taken place. It might be somewhere for bored teenagers to gather now, but Sarah could only imagine the horrors that had gone on within these walls. Her father, however, had valuable first-hand knowledge, and it infuriated Sarah that he was unwilling to share it. She scratched at the flaky varnish on the banister and surveyed the staircase. The floorboards were rotten, though, and she knew it would be madness to attempt to climb them. Double swing doors lay ahead, the hinges squeaking as she pushed her way through. A seemingly endless corridor stretched out in front of her, plaster hanging off the walls, the floors strewn with splinters of wood. She crouched down and pulled the floor plan out of her bag, smoothing it out on the ground. There was over 4 miles of corridors, so she'd adopted a methodical approach to exploring the building and had carefully highlighted the areas she had already covered. Once she'd got her bearings, she replaced the floor plan and retrieved her notebook. Rain trickled in through the gaps in the rafters, accentuating the mouldy stench and the general rotting ambiance of the derelict building. There was silence, apart from the rhythmical plip-plop of the raindrops. She shuddered and took a furtive 360 survey of her surroundings. She would never get used to the eerie walls with their unsettling graffiti, the creepy corridors and the long-buried secrets that her father seemed determined would remain that way. She froze at the sound of a scuffle coming from a side room. Rats. She'd encountered them before, and no matter how many times she told herself that they were more scared of her than she was of them, it made no difference. She still hated the scurrying blighters with their long, hairless tails and beady black eyes. She stamped her feet, and feeling slightly stupid, shouted at them to bugger off. Silence descended once more, and she laughed quietly to herself. That showed them. But as she stared at the opening to the side room, its door hanging off its hinges, the darkness inside pointing to a lack of windows, she heard it again. A shuffling of feet, far too heavy to be a rat. She swallowed hard. Hello? Is there anybody there? A hooded figure emerged from the gloom, arms outstretched and moving towards her in a zombie-like fashion. She expelled a breath of relief. Nathan, you bloody idiot! What are you trying to do to me? He pulled down his hood and grinned at her. Sorry, I couldn't resist. What are you doing in here at this time anyway? Too wet to be on the streets today. I chose to give it a swerve. I thought beggars couldn't be choosers. He shrugged. Got any fags? She ferreted around in her shoulder bag. No, I haven't got any bloody fags. She thrust a package towards him. Here, have these and be grateful. He unwrapped the silver foil and crammed a cheese and ham sandwich into his mouth. Thanks, he mumbled. I am grateful, honest. He pulled the sandwich apart and peered inside. Could have done with some pickle, though. They sat down side by side on the hard floor as Nathan munched his way through her sandwiches. Their paths had crossed a few weeks earlier, when Sarah had stumbled upon him asleep in one of the wards. At first she'd thought it was just a bundle of old clothes, until she had prodded him with her foot. He'd been sleeping rough following a series of blazing rows with his parents, after which he'd stormed out vowing never to return. Since then they had become friends of sorts, although at 20 years his senior she did have the instinct to mother him, in spite of the fact, or maybe because of it, that she had no children of her own. Her thoughts turned to Dan, and the familiar bitterness washed over her. She shook her head to clear away the memories. It didn't do to dwell. What's done is done. She watched Nathan wolf down the last of the sandwiches, crumbs settling along the fine blonde hair on his top lip. Nathan? Hmm? He continued to chew noisily. Why won't you let me help you? He pointed to his cheeks, puffed out like a hamster's. You are helping me, he mumbled. No, Nathan, that's just a sticking plaster. I mean really help you. Get you back on your feet again. I'm all right. Winter's coming. What are you going to do then?
Dunno. Stay here, I suppose.
He looked up at the ceiling as a large raindrop landed on his head.
May we go to London?
You're only 18. You've got your whole life ahead of you. He scoffed.
That's what worries me.
She glared at him. He was a stubborn so-and-so, all right. Considering he'd been living rough for a couple of months, he could have looked a lot worse, though. His body odour had the distinctive tang of an overripe Stilton, but his blue eyes were bright, and his skin was surprisingly smooth for one who did not have regular access to a razor. His blonde fringe was too long, and he had a habit of shaking his head in order to flick it out of his eyes. She delved into her bag again, and brought out a bottle of water. He looked at the label.
"I don't suppose there's any chance you've filled this with vodka, is there?"
"Spoken like a true down-and-out," she shook her head. "What do you think?" He unscrewed the cap and took a long drink.
"What are we exploring today, then?"
he said, changing the subject. She knew when she was beaten, but it would not stop her trying again another day. She placed the floor plan between them and pointed to a long corridor with numerous rooms off each side.
"This one, is it today?"
He struggled to his feet, unfurling himself to his 6-foot height, his jeans barely clinging to his bony hips, and held out his hand. She took it and he heaved her into a standing position. She brushed herself down, flicking off bits of grit and dust.
"Thanks."
They walked side by side along the corridor, passing wards still full of metal-framed beds, complete with stained mattresses, the horsehair stuffing spilling out onto the cracked tiled floors. In one side room stood an old dentist's chair, in its reclined position, rusty instruments still on a tray beside it. They came to a corridor of tiny rooms, each barricaded with a thick steel door. Sarah closed one eye and squinted through a peephole. "Looks like a padded cell.
Bloody hell, I wonder what they were used for.
Here, I wonder if your old man was ever shoved in one of those. He was a nutter, wasn't he?"
"Nathan," she admonished, "my father was not mentally ill. Why would you jump to such a conclusion? People were sent to asylums for all sorts of spurious reasons back then. Not everyone was mad, and in any case, my..."
He grabbed hold of her arm.
"This one's open. Will you lock me in?"
"What on earth for?"
"I just want to see what it's like. Go on, it'll be fun."
"Fun? You need to get out more, Nathan." He heaved the door open and entered the tiny room. The floor was spongy and the walls were lined with canvas and padded with horsehair.
"Are you sure you want to do this?"
asked Sarah, closing the door behind him. His reply was muffled. Sarah looked through the peephole, but the blackness had swallowed him. She counted to 10 before opening the door again. He stepped out, grinning.
"That was awesome."
She cringed at the use of the adjective. Clearly Nathan had led a sheltered life if he thought 10 seconds standing in the darkness of a padded cell was awesome. Poor bugger.
"Come on, you."
She pulled him out, but couldn't help smiling at his beaming face.
"We've got work to do."
They reached the end of the corridor, the atmosphere now cool and clammy. There were only 2 tiny windows high up on the wall ahead, which did not let in nearly enough light.
"What now?" asked Nathan.
"I'm sure there should be a door around here somewhere." Sarah studied the floor plan again. "Yep, there should definitely be a door along this wall." She stood, hands on hips, surveying the corridor. Her gaze settled on a large wardrobe, one of its doors completely missing, the other one clinging on by a single hinge. She moved towards it.
"Hang on a minute. Look at this, Nathan."
The back of the wardrobe was also missing. They both stared at the door behind, the blue paint peeling off in large curls.
"There it is," declared Sarah. "I knew there should be a door here."
Nathan stuck his head inside the wardrobe and twisted the knob on the door.
"Blimey, all we need now is a lion and a witch."
He heaved the wardrobe out of the way and Sarah charged at the door with her shoulder. Then, when it failed to give, kicked at it with her boots. Nathan intervened.
"You'll hurt yourself, Sarah. Here, let me."
He turned the handle patiently, listening for a click, and after a few jiggles, the door opened.
"Just needed a little coaxing, that's all. There's no need to go at everything like a bull in a china shop." As their eyes adjusted to the gloom, they both stared up at the narrow wooden staircase behind the door. Nathan grimaced at Sarah and gestured with his arm.
After you. You're such a gentleman, not to mention a coward.
Well, it does look a bit creepy.
Says the man who sleeps in a derelict lunatic asylum every night.
She tentatively tested the strength of the first stair, then, satisfied that it would take her weight, crept up to the top.
What can you see?
Called Nathan from below.
There's another smaller door, really low. I'll have to bend down to get in. Wait for me, then. You can't go in on your own.
They both crouched at the top of the stairs as Sarah turned the handle. The key was still in the lock, and without much effort, she was able to push the door open into a small windowless attic space. She reached into her bag, pulled out her pen torch, and moved the dim light around the room, its beam lighting up layers of dust and cobwebs. A single bulb hung from the ceiling, covered in an opaque layer of grime. Nathan pointed to the far side of the room. There's something over there. Sarah made her way across to where stacks of suitcases were piled up under the eaves. Nathan, she breathed. Come over here. I found something. He shuffled over to join her, his lanky frame making it awkward for him to move. He spoke in hushed tones.
Why are we whispering?
Look at all these cases. She pulled down the top one and blew off a cloud of dust. A brown luggage label was tied to the handle with a piece of frayed string. He peered over her shoulder.
Is there a name?
She squinted at the label. No, just a number. 43/7.
Here, hold this.
She passed him the torch and with her thumbs tried to flip up the catches either side of the handle, but they were rusted and stiff.
Damn, I think it might be locked.
Nathan intervened. Here, let me have a go. Seconds later, he had managed to pop the catches, and he slid the case over to Sarah.
I'll let you open it.
Thanks. She wiped her clammy hands on the bottom of her sweatshirt, knelt down and gently eased the lid of the case open.
God, this hasn't been touched for years.
She had almost lifted the lid clear when it suddenly exploded like an airbag from a dashboard. She scuttled back in alarm as Nathan jumped and banged his head on the wooden rafters.
What the hell is that?
She exclaimed. Nathan slung his arm across her body and shone the torch in the case.
I've got this.
He edged forward and poked at the mound of white material with his toe. Sarah pushed him out of the way and bent down to touch the fabric.
Feels like silk.
She picked it up and shook it free. The folds of the material creased with age.
It's a wedding dress.
She ran her fingers over the row of tiny pearls on the neckline.
It's beautiful, but I wonder what on earth it's doing in here.
It's been worn too, judging by the yellow stains under the armpits.
She was a big lass, Nathan observed. Family of four could go camping under that thing.
He picked up a black and white photograph from the case.
And look at this.
They both studied the picture of the young man in uniform. He had his back to the camera but was looking over his shoulder, grinning into the lens, a cigarette hanging from his lips. He had the rugged good looks of a 40s film star. At least he would have done if someone hadn't gouged his eyes out. Sarah held the photograph up and shone the torch behind it, the beam piercing the holes where his eyes should have been.
Blimey, you must have really upset someone. This is absolutely fascinating. Let's have a look in some of the others.
The attic space was long but low, the piles of cases wedged under the woodworm-infested eaves, varying colours and sizes, but all with a brown luggage label hanging off the handle. Sarah dragged down another case and flicked it open. She thumbed through the musty clothes, wrinkling her nose at the stale smell. Nathan pulled out a moth-eaten old jumper.
Hey, looks like I found myself a new wardrobe.
Sarah glared at him.
Don't you touch any of this stuff, do you hear me?
He held his palms aloft.
All right, I was only joking.
Sarah rubbed her chin, frowning in concentration.
We need to be methodical with this lot.
She scanned the room.
There must be 20-odd cases here, each with a story to tell.
She grabbed Nathan by the arm, her voice an excited whisper.
This is a gold mine, Nathan. You mustn't tell anybody about it.
He shrugged. Who am I going to tell? She took her camera out of the bag and flicked up the flash, snapping furiously at the stacks of suitcases.
This is going to make a great cover for the book.
She knelt down and rocked back on her heels, scrolling through the photographs she had just taken. Nathan hovered over her shoulder.
I'll help you if you like.
She studied him in the half-light, his pupils dilated, his mouth pulled into a wide smile. She'd never seen him look so animated.
Thanks. I'd like that.
She hesitated.
I'll pay you, of course.
That's not why I offered. I want to help you. That's all. I don't expect anything in return. She patted his knee. You're a good lad, Nathan. She stood up as straight as the low roof would allow and massaged her neck.
We can't do much in this gloom. I'll come back tomorrow with a couple of lanterns and we'll start properly then.
She packed away her camera.
Why don't you come home with me, at least for a bath and a hot meal?
He shook his head.
I can't. I've told you before. Please, just leave it.
Chapter 2. The rain had eased off by the time she arrived home. Her father was in the front garden, pulling up weeds, still wearing his shirt and tie, his sleeves neatly rolled up to the elbow.
I'm back,
she announced, unnecessarily. How was the cemetery? He wiped his brow, leaving a faint smudge of soil across his forehead.
Not too bad. I took a stiff brush to the headstone, got some of the muck off. Bloody birds had been doing their business all over it.
She turned to go indoors, but stopped when he called her name.
Sarah, have you given any thought as to when you might move back into your own place?
She hesitated, searching for any hidden meaning behind his words.
Well, I'm not sure. I thought you liked me living here. Are you saying you want me to go?
His tone was matter-of-fact, dismissive almost.
Well, you can't stay here forever, can you? I've got to learn to be on my own again.
He paused and loosened the knot in his tie.
And so have you.
It was the first time he had mentioned her situation in such blunt terms. He knew only too well how much she hated living alone in her soulless apartment. She couldn't talk about this just now. She stared at him and changed the subject.
I found something really fascinating at Ambergate this morning.
He visibly bristled.
Sarah,
he warned.
No, it's all right. I know you don't want anything to do with it. I'm just telling you. I found a pile of old suitcases in an attic. I'm going to document the contents for my book.
She didn't wait for a response, but skipped over the threshold, leaving him standing there deep in thought, a worried crease across his forehead.
Are you familiar with spreadsheets?
Sarah flipped open the laptop and sat cross-legged on the attic floor beside Nathan.
I'm homeless, not thick.
She had placed two battery-operated lanterns on the floor at either end of the attic space, which gave off sufficient light in which to work.
Sorry. Here, look at this. I've made a sheet with these column headings. Label, number, description of case, contents. All we need to do now is populate it.
Sounds simple enough. Give it here, then. She passed him the laptop, then shuffled over to the case they had opened the day before.
We might as well start with this one, as it's already open. I'll call out the details and you type them in, okay?
He gave a salute.
Yes, boss.
Right, label number 43/7.
Nathan tapped away on the keyboard.
Description of case, she continued. Navy blue with brown leather reinforced corners. Contents, one white silk wedding dress,
one black and white photograph of a young man in uniform. She picked up an item between her thumb and forefinger and held it at arm's length. One pair of... She peered into the case again. Nope. Several pairs of knickers, all white. Well, whitish. She sighed. God, this is a glamorous job. After 2 hours, they had documented and photographed around half of the cases. None had contained anything more exciting than clothes, books and toiletries, but all were poignant in their own way. How did one pack for a stay in a lunatic asylum? And why had all these people left without their possessions? Sarah rubbed her face and reached over for the cool bag she had brought. Time for some refreshments, I think. She pulled out a bag of crisps and lobbed them at Nathan. Here you go. He caught the packet. Cheers. Have you saved that document? He tottered and looked up to the rafters. Yes, I'm not daft. She studied him through narrowed eyes. You did go to school then? He shoved a handful of crisps into his mouth. Sometimes, he said eventually. Other times I bonked off. Where? Where what? Where did you go to school? Comprehensive. All Hallows. It's not round here. You a Catholic, then? What? No. Jesus, Sarah, what's with the Inquisition? She poured two cups of tea from the thermos. I'm only making conversation, Nathan. No need to get all defensive. He took a cup from her. I'm sorry. I just don't like talking about the past. I was... bullied at school. Holds very bad memories for me. Must have been tough. Yeah, it was. She left a pause, watching him as he gnawed at the skin around his thumb. Why don't you go back home, Nathan? I'm sure your parents must be frantic with worry. I know if it was my son who'd... He cut her off. You don't know anything about it. There's no way they'll be spending 1 second worrying about me. Please, he implored. Just leave it. You're wasting your time. She left a pause, waiting for him to calm down. Why are you so angry, Nathan? Oh, I'm not, he sighed. I'm sorry you bit your head off, okay? It's just... Oh, look, I'm fed up of talking about me. Tell me something about you now, such good friends. Are you married? She absently massaged her finger where her wedding ring used to be. No, not anymore. Oh, sorry. How long were you married then? 10 years? Wow, that's a long time. What happened? She flicked him playfully on the arm. Nosy bugger, aren't you? Oh, but it's all right for you to give me the third degree. She brought her knees up to her chest and laid her forehead against them. Closing her eyes, she allowed a vision of Dan into her head. It was painful to remember him, but the thought of forgetting him was even worse. We had everything, Dan and I. At least that's what it looked like from the outside. A big house, fancy cars, a hectic social life. 2 foreign holidays a year, all the shallow things that seemed to make other people envious. But we really did love each other. Sounds great. Where did it all go wrong? She gave a rueful smile. We didn't have the one thing we craved and longed for. He raised his eyebrows. Which was? A baby. Oh. We spent a small fortune on IVF, but the cost couldn't only be measured in financial terms. The emotional cost was far greater. I knew I'd become obsessed with having a child, so obsessed, in fact, that I ignored every other aspect of our marriage. Nathan pulled a face and placed his hands over his ears. Where's this going? She laughed. I'll spare you the details, Nathan. But 9 months ago, Dan suddenly announced that he'd never wanted children and he'd only gone along with all the IVF nonsense, as he called it, for my sake. The heartless bastard. Yep, needless to say, our marriage collapsed, and I am single again at the age of 38, with any hope of ever having a baby diminishing with every passing month. Is there any chance of the two of you getting back together? I'm not sure his pregnant girlfriend would go for that. Nathan spluttered on his tea. What? Oh, yeah, Dan moved on with alarming speed. Found a girlfriend almost half his age who he managed to impregnate within 2 months of their first meeting. She shook her head. He couldn't make it up. You'll meet someone else, Nathan said. You're very attractive for a... Well, he faltered as he struggled to find the right words. Very attractive for an older woman, were you going to say? Nathan smacked his forehead. Ah, sorry, I'm not good at this. Where am I going to meet anyone? I divide my time between my job at the library and wandering around this place. These things happen when you least expect them to. She fell silent, picked up a stick and began to trace circles in the dirt on the floor. Sarah? She took a deep breath and snapped the stick in two. It's so hard to imagine being with anyone else. Dan and I were together a long time. No matter how much I know he's hurt me, it's still difficult just to switch off my feelings for him. It would be easier to hate him, but I can't. She heaved herself up. Come on, that's enough of my woes. Let's quack on, shall we? In a well-worn routine, she hefted down another case, placed it on the floor, and sat down in front of it. Right, label number 56/178. God knows what all these numbers mean. There's no rhyme or reason to them. Okay, description. Brown leather, somewhat battered. She attempted to flick up the catch, but it was stuck fast. Damn, I think this one's locked. How annoying. She turned to Nathan. Do you have a Swiss Army knife or anything? He patted himself down theatrically. No, I must have forgotten to pack one when I stormed out. Ignoring his sarcastic reply, she shoved the case to one side. We'll have to deal with that one another time, then. 2 hours later, all the cases had been opened, documented, and restacked, and they were both stiff from sitting on the bare floorboards in the cramped attic. Sarah stretched her arms over her head and yawned. Oh, thanks for all your help, Nathan. I do appreciate it. My pleasure. I've not exactly got a busy schedule. She stared at the only unopened case. A pity we can't get into that one, though. I hate leaving a job unfinished. She fiddled with the catch again. I'll bring a hair grip or something tomorrow. Nathan? He was on his hands and knees, holding a lantern in front of his face. Squinting in the fading light, he ran his hand along the rough floorboards, his fingers digging between the grooves. What are you doing? I saw something. He put the lantern down and used both hands to try and work the floorboard loose. There was something glinting in the light. He fumbled around, cursing as a splinter of wood pierced his finger. Ouch! Sarah shuffled over to him. Let me have a look. She took hold of his hand and ran her thumb over the end of his finger. I need to get that out. She pressed hard, easing the tiny fragment of wood out from under his skin. Ow, that hurts! Oh, don't be such a baby. Here. She showed him the splinter. It's out. Now, what were you looking for? He sucked his finger and nodded towards the floorboards. There's something wedged in there. Sarah followed his gaze, bending down to get a closer look. You're right. She picked the object with her fingernail until she managed to flick it out. They both stared at the small brass key. Well, 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 said Sarah. It looks like we won't be needing that hair grip after all. She pulled the last case towards her and slipped the key into the lock. After a bit of jiggling around, the catch popped open with a satisfying click. Bingo, she whispered. She lifted the lid and gave a low whistle. Well, this is a bit different. The painting that sat on top of the rest of the contents was almost as large as the case itself. She glanced at her watch, aware of the advancing hour. Okay, one watercolour, unframed, and signed by... She pulled her reading glasses down from the top of her head. Signed by Millie McCarthy, I think it said. Nathan looked up from the keyboard, his eyes wide. At last, a name. I wonder why she was in here. Sarah continued to pick through the contents, dictating to Nathan. A pebble painted with a pink flower, a hairbrush. She ran her fingers through the soft bristles and pulled out a strand of fair hair. She was holding the DNA of someone who had lived and quite possibly died here. The hairbrush was part of a set. Pink padded silk on the back, with a mother-of-pearl handle and a matching mirror. Correction, she said. A hairbrush and mirror set. She could hear Nathan tapping the delete key. She paused to let him catch up. Oh, look at this! She held up a knitted teddy made from odds and sods of different coloured wool. An unexpected lump formed in her throat, and she found it difficult to carry on. What's up? Asked Nathan. Nothing. She sniffed. She composed herself before continuing. One hand-knitted teddy. She propped the soft toy in the lid of the case. One, two, three floral dresses and... Oh, my God. She picked up the tiny blue jacket and held it to her nose. One baby's matinee jacket. Blue. Nathan was unmoved. How'd you spell that? B-L-U-E, she replied absently. Yes, thank you, Sarah. I meant that other word. The matinee, what's it? Oh, matinee, M-A-T-I-N-E-E. Anything else in there? He asked. Sarah stroked the soft wool, then held it to her cheek. With the other hand, she swept the bottom of the case, her fingers alighting on a piece of paper which had been folded in two. She put down the jacket and opened the note. The first four words had been printed in capital letters, and she didn't need her reading glasses to absorb the full impact of them. What in the name of... Nathan stopped typing. What's up? She turned and wordlessly passed him the note. What's this? He frowned as he read the words, a puzzled look crossing his face. Jesus Christ, he whispered. Chapter 3. November 1956. She remembered the last time she had walked through these gates and down the potholed drive, edging her way towards the intimidating grandeur of the building. On that occasion, too, she had been sick with nerves, her lips dry and flaky, but no saliva with which to moisten them. She glanced at the navy sky. With daylight still an hour away, the early morning mist had not yet lifted, and the grass verges sparkled with frost. She pulled her cape tightly across her chest and blew out a deep, calming breath, which crystallized before her eyes as it met with the cold air. As she rounded the bend and the imposing building came into view, the water tower dominating the skyline, her nerves were quelled by the tiniest frisson of excitement. On her very first day in the classroom, her tutor had informed them that all the Victorian asylums had been built at the end of long winding tracks, surrounded by high walls hidden from the public. Growing up in the shadow of Ambergate, or the Big House, as they had all called it, she had heard a fair few horror stories over the years, and her young imagination had conjured up images of half-naked inmates with caveman hair and wild eyes hiding in the shrubbery, unintelligible sounds coming from their drooling mouths. Nobody in her family had known with any certainty what went on behind these walls, but she could hear her mother's threatening voice in her ear as she scolded Ellen or her younger brother. "You two drive me insane! I swear I'll end up in Ambergate!" or if they had been particularly naughty, I'll get the men in white coats to cart you off to the big house if you don't behave.
Even the threat of a good hiding was preferable to that terrifying fate. As she approached the main entrance, her thoughts turned to all the unfortunate people housed within this vast warehouse for the insane, many of them abandoned and forgotten by their families. She set her mouth into a grim line of determination and adopted a more purposeful stride as she climbed the stone steps and dug her thumb into the button by the side of the door. The bell rang long and shrill, and before she'd had time to adjust her cap, the door was opened by a small woman in a tweed suit who peered at her over her wire spectacles.
"Good morning."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Name?"
"Oh, good morning. My name's Ellen, Ellen Crosby."
The woman opened the door a little further, allowing Ellen to cross the threshold. The clinical smell of disinfectant and overboiled cabbage hit the back of her throat. Memories of the last time she'd been here flooded back. It was the day of the entrance examination, and she'd been led to a classroom at the end of a seemingly endless corridor. The room was airless and stuffy, the only sounds coming from her pen scratching on the paper as she wrote, and the occasional knocking of the water hammer in the pipes. She had only managed to complete around two-thirds of the paper, so was somewhat surprised when a few weeks later a letter arrived offering her a position as a student psychiatric nurse. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that she'd been the only one taking the exam. She'd spent the previous 4 years working in a clothing factory, and although the pay was good, the hours were long and the work monotonous. Whilst it was true that her mother appreciated the money her daughter brought into the family home, she knew that Ellen had always harboured a desire to go into nursing. For her 6th birthday, Mrs. Crosby had made her daughter a simple nurse's uniform, and the young girl had not taken it off for 2 whole weeks. With the war still on, it hadn't been easy to get the materials, but Mrs. Crosby had sacrificed an old pillowcase and a pale blue blouse, which admittedly had seen better days, but was good for a few more years yet. And it was Mrs. Crosby who had left the paper open on the kitchen table, showing the situation's vacant column. She had drawn a red ring around psychiatric students wanted. No academic qualifications needed. The warning bells should have gone off right then.
"I said you to start on F10, long stay."
Ellen stared at the woman who was now holding a clipboard.
"What? Oh, sorry, of course. Which way is that?"
"I'll get someone to come and show you momentarily. You can wait here for now."
She gestured to a wooden pew and Ellen perched on the edge and rested her bag on her knee. She'd been too nervous to eat breakfast, and now her stomach rumbled, the hollow sound echoing round the room. She rummaged in her coat pocket for a mint to take the edge off.
"Student Nurse Crosby?"
A rather rotund woman with a doughy face extended a chapped hand towards her. Ellen shook it, the calloused palm feeling more like leather than skin.
"Yes, that's me. How do you do?"
"Very well, thank you. I'm Sister Winstanley. You call me Sister, all right?"
Without waiting for an answer, she turned and headed back in the direction she had come from.
"Follow me."
Ellen trailed behind, marvelling at how a woman of Sister Winstanley's size managed to walk at such a brisk pace when surely her thighs must be chafing together. Sister's office was situated at the end of the ward, and as Ellen trotted through, she stole a glance at the shapes slumbering in the beds either side of her. There didn't seem to be any privacy for the patients, no curtains to pull round, and no more than a foot or two between each bed. Despite the fact that the place looked spotless, there was a fusty smell in the air, no doubt coming from the bodies stagnating beneath the sheets.
"Have a seat."
Sister made it sound like an order as she gestured towards the chair in front of her desk.
"Now, have you had breakfast?"
Ellen shook her head. "No, I couldn't."
"Tell me, how do you expect to make it through a 14-hour shift on an empty stomach?"
"Well, I couldn't force anything down. I was too..."
Sister held up her palm. Please, don't say nervous. This is no place for the fearful, you know. You need to be strong, assert your authority, and start as you mean to go on.
She banged a fist down on the desk, causing her cup to rattle in its saucer. Never mind the 6 weeks you've spent in training school. That was a doddle. You've arrived at the coalface now.
She paused to let her words sink in. You sure you've got the stomach for it?
Ellen straightened in her chair and tilted her chin upwards, forcing a note of conviction into her words.
Oh, yes, sister. Yes, I have.
Sister stared at her for a few seconds, her frown registering a slight doubt.
Good, then we'll get along fine.
She stood up, a trace of a smile on her lips.
Couple of boiled eggs, do you?
Ellen had just finished scooping out the last of the egg when she was startled by a presence in the doorway. She could hear Sister at the other end of the ward telling another patient not to stand in the chamber pot. She turned and smiled at the patient hovering nearby.
Good morning. My name's Nurse Crosby, and you are?
The old lady stared through her, the whites of her eyes yellow and her irises a shade of murky blue. Her mouth caved in around her toothless gums, giving her the look of an emaciated gargoyle. Ellen stood up and took hold of the old lady's liver-spotted hand, the translucent skin making the veins beneath resemble a relief map.
Can I get you something?
The old lady continued to stare, didn't nod or shake her head, nothing. Her thin cotton nightdress had come undone and was gaping open at the front. Ellen retied it to preserve her modesty. The woman might not care that she was exposing herself, but Ellen did. Sister Winstanley appeared in the doorway, a murderous look on her face. She took a firm hold of the patient's arm.
How many times? You're not to get up until you're told. Now, back to bed, Gertie. Go on. I'll fetch your teeth shortly.
She tutted at Ellen. It's like herding cats sometimes. The old lady shuffled wordlessly back to her bed, feeling her way along the wall. She walked with an exaggerated limp, dragging her left leg.
Why is she in here?
Asked Ellen.
Old Gertie.
Sister shrugged.
I'm sure I don't know. It's not my job to know. I'd have to look it up. Been here 40-odd years, I believe, but I've never heard her speak yet.
Ellen did a quick mental calculation.
You mean she's been here since before the war, the first one?
Sister rubbed her chin and eyed Ellen up and down.
She's well looked after. She gets fed 3 times a day, a bath as often as we can manage it, sometimes a walk if we've got time.
You make her sound like a dog.
Look, student, Nurse Crosby.
Sister put her hands on her hips.
It's your first day, so I'm going to let that one pass. You have to understand that some of these patients could not function on the outside. They're completely institutionalized, and it would be cruel to turf them out. They wouldn't last a day. But... Enough! You're testing my patience now, and I've not got time to stand around debating the issue.
She ran her hands down her stiff starched apron and softened her tone a little.
We do our best for them, you know. Where would Gertie be without us, eh?
Ellen glanced at the old lady, who was now sitting on the edge of her bed, picking at the skin around her fingernails. She had undone the ties on her nightdress again, exposing herself for the whole ward to see.
"Why don't you start with toileting Gertie?"
Sister said. Ellen nodded.
"All right, I can do that."
"And don't take all day about it. We've got 30-odd patients to get up and dress before breakfast."
Ellen approached Gertie, helped her off the bed, and linked one arm through hers.
Come on then, Gertie, let's get you to the bathroom, shall we?
There was no response. She guided the old lady into the toilet block and gestured towards a cubicle.
Will this one do?
Still silence as Gertie backed into the cubicle,
hoisted up her nightdress and settled herself on the toilet seat. Startled to see there was no door on the cubicle, Ellen turned away to give her some privacy and busied herself straightening up the towels. The lumps of carbolic soap in the sinks were cracked and ingrained with dirt, and she made a mental note to ask for some more. She turned round as she heard Gertie coming out of the cubicle.
"Hold on, I'll just flush the..."
She faltered, momentarily stuck for words.
"Oh, dear God, what have you got there?"
Gertie held out her palm. It was smeared with brown streaks, as was the front of her nightdress and the walls of the cubicle.
"What? Oh, God, that's dirty. Gertie!"
Nothing she had learned in training school had prepared her for this. She grabbed the old woman's hands, thrust them under the hot tap and lathered up the dubious-looking soap. Then she took one of the towels off the rail, soaked it in hot water, and swabbed the walls of the toilet cubicle, the stench causing her to retch as she tried to breathe through just her mouth. She was certainly regretting those boiled eggs.
"Gertie, that was very naughty,"
she chastised, fully aware that she sounded as though she was speaking to a child. Sister bobbed her head round the door.
"What on earth?"